Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Happy for a Friday. We got a great guest today in a couple of great hours. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe, of course, a very, very fine apologist and the author of Pope Peter and some other books, and just very well known from his work on the internet as an apologist. And we're just so happy he's our colleague now. Second hour, you can ask him anything you want. We'll just open it up and we'll make it an open forum second hour. But first hour, we're going to talk about bishops in the early church. Were there bishops in the early church? This is actually a point of dispute because if there were bishops, say, I don't know, appointed and ordained by the apostles, well, that would say something about the structure of the apostolic church. But if there weren't, that would also say something about the fundamentals of the apostolic church. And you are welcome to call, whether you think that there were bishops or were not, or if you'd just like to know something about where this whole idea of bishops came from. 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer, father for the second time just this summer. How are you, Joe?
Doing great.
And how's the little James Campion?
Yeah, he's really good. I was telling Darren earlier, he's much better now at articulating his wants and dislikes. And unfortunately, there's a lot of things that fall in the second category, like not being held upright all the time.
Oh, he's a demanding little fella.
I don't know where he gets it. No idea.
And is his sister a little more gentle with him now? I remember last time.
Yeah, she is. She is getting really cute with him. It's great actually watching her. Anytime he starts to cry, she'll say like, "Baby boy, crying," and just like immediately wants him to let us know. Like, it could be like the smallest like little whimper in his sleep, and she will like make sure we know about it.
Oh, so that's very nice. That is sweet. Again, our number is 888-318-7884. We're talking about the bishops in the early church. There's certain basic claims that most Christians make about bishops. Those claims broadly rejected by a kind of emerging branches of Christianity in the 16th century, in the early to mid 1500s. Maybe start with the basics. Joe, can you just answer the first question, a yes or no question? Were there bishops in the earliest church?
There were. So when we say this, I want to be really clear what it is, like the idea that I'm defending, that a lot of Protestants will tell you and a lot of secular scholars will tell you that the first generation or two, or the first 150 years, or the first 200 years, they're different theories, right? They'll say, originally, there were just two branches of church governance. You had elders, and you had deacons. And the Catholic response has always been, no, it's always been three branches. A bishop per church, per city. And then elders, or presbyters. Later, the word presbyter gets shortened to priest. And then deacons. Like, that's what we find as early as we look everywhere that there's clear evidence. And so I want to really stress this. Like, it's not just that you'll find elders who are called bishops. It's like, no, you'll actually find in every church we get a good enough look at to see what the governance of the church looks like, that there's one guy where the buck stops. There's one guy who has final spiritual authority in a role that we would now call the bishop. And very, very, very early on, he is called the bishop. And the evidence is pretty overwhelming. This is every church on earth, not just like a general norm. So we're talking about by the like early 200s, we have literally hundreds of examples of this in the churches of North Africa where we can actually tell you who the bishop was because the record keeping was preserved there. So this is not like different churches did things different ways. This is like, no, the apostles set up a bishop, elders, deacons, and the early Christians preserved that and kept careful records about preserving that. And their reasons, like the reasons the apostles did that, were not just like pragmatic, but they were probably rooted in the fact that there's a threefold structure in the Jewish hierarchy where you have high priest, priest, Levite. And they're also rooted in theology. So St. Ignatius of Antioch, very early on, makes a connection between the fact that there's one bishop and the fact there's one God, that a church that believes the world is governed by monotheism believes that the local church is governed by monoepiscopacy is the technical term for it, like just meaning one bishop, like that, we don't have a pantheon of gods. We don't have a pantheon of co-ruling elders. That's the idea. So that's it in a nutshell.
888-318-7884, the number. Two questions present themselves immediately. And while we're screening some calls, I will ask you the two questions, or kind of objections, I suppose, that present themselves immediately. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you are Christian or not, you're welcome to call and ask about bishops in the earliest church, 888-318-7884. Okay, so here are the two objections, and you take them in any order you want. Even if there were bishops in the early church, the Catholic assertion that this is connected to what the apostles intended for the church, or even what Jesus intended for the church, is tenuous at best. Okay, so first objection is, what's the apostolic connection? And the second is, we often hear a kind of a thing about, well, yeah, but when you look at Rome, for example, it's kind of like there's Peter, and then there's a bunch of guys that are left behind. There's no, and they'll say monarchical episcopacy. You know, there's no evidence of a, and you made the claim, there's one guy. Those are your exact words. There's one guy. So answer my objections in any order you want, that this is not really connected to Jesus and the apostles. And, you know, maybe there was a kind of a group of leaders, but there's no monarchical episcopacy.
Yeah. So we have the Christians of the 100s telling us that they got this from the Christians before them, going back to the apostles. And the difficulty when we're looking at the super early evidence is that there's just not a ton of writings from like the first century and the early part of the second century, that we have a lot more writings from like about 150 and onward. But I'll speak to, as we go on through the hour, St. Ignatius of Antioch, who has a whole lot to say about this threefold structure with the monarchical bishop. But I want to actually begin with a guy named Hegesippus, whose writings are mostly lost to us. He was a historian from the second century. This is a guy who lives roughly 110 to 180. So very early on, the Apostle John probably died about 10 years before he was born. And Hegesippus, around the middle part of the 100s, like 157 to 168, he goes to Rome. And he writes that when he goes there, he drew up a list of succession of bishops down to Anicetus, and then mentions that his deacon, two bishops later, became bishop. So he's actually able to trace, you know, really accurately the specific line in Rome. And he describes this as going back, the succession of bishops, right? And so Irenaeus, writing around 180, says the same thing, that he says every apostolic church, meaning every church founded by the apostles, in order to prove that it's founded by the apostles, would keep records about exactly who their bishops were, one bishop after another after another. And so he's able to likewise trace each one of the bishops of Rome, beginning with the apostles, Peter and Paul, having founded and built up the church. They then pass it off to Linus, and then Cletus, Clement, Evaristus, Sixtus, Telephorus, and onwards. He's able to name every single bishop for the first really 115, 120 years of the church, from the time of the death of the apostles to about 180 when he's writing. So he's able to name the first 12 popes. That tells us two things, three things, really. One, it tells us this really does go back to the apostles. Two, that we know it goes back to the apostles, not just because, like, there was a legend going around, but because, like, the Christians, A, were living through it, and B, we're like keeping track of this with like good written records, and not just in Rome, but all over the church. And three, that this is something that like everybody knew about. Like, this was not just, you got to take Irenaeus's word for it, you got to take Hegesippus' word for it. Like, they would use this point against heretics. So Irenaeus mentions all of this when he's combating heresy to show, look, your heresy can't be true because we know where the church came from. And these are the people who got the true teaching from the apostles, and here's who got it from them. And being able to trace that was a really important part of how the second century church combated heresy. To say, yeah, they're just making it all up, if that were true, the heretics would have certainly pointed out, like, you guys are just making this up. Like, it would have been a very effective point for the Gnostics or whoever to come back and say, we've never heard of apostolic succession, or we've never heard of any of these records you're talking about. And they don't do that. So cumulatively, we can say with a high degree of certainty that the apostles did start this, that the early Christians knew they started it. And this is true in Rome as well as in other places across the church.
Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. We're talking about bishops in the early church. If the early church looked like the Catholic Church, that is, if it had bishops, priests, and deacons, as the Catholic Church does now, as the Orthodox churches do, as most of Christianity does, and if that church practiced the sacraments as the church does now, celebrating the Eucharist on Sundays and baptizing and doing all the other things, including forgiving sins and ordaining and anointing the sick, then that would suggest that the Catholic Church is has maintained a continuity with the church that was founded by Christ himself. And it is that church persisting into the world today. If that's not the case, if there weren't bishops, if there weren't sacraments in the early church, then that argument for the Catholic faith is much undermined. So it's important that we get these things straight. Whether you're Catholic, Protestant, or other, you are welcome to call with your questions about the early bishops, 888-318-7884. And before I send you off to the break, I think the alliterations are almost coming to an end, but today is $5 Friday. We're nearing the end of alliterative August, but we thought we'd end on a high note. It's our $5 Friday flash sale at shop.catholic.com, and we've got dozens of great books, CDs, DVDs for just $5. Savings up to 80% on some items, and you don't want to miss out on this. Come and shop. shop.catholic.com and take advantage of $5 Friday.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary. Designed exclusively for EWTN by premier Italian rosary maker Gorelli, in collaboration with renowned Catholic sculptor Timothy Schmalz, help build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary. Available now at EWTNRC.com. Order your National Life Rosary today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer wrote the book Pope Peter, which many have, and I've seen the reviews lauded as just the best book out there for a general audience, describing the continuity of the papacy and its purpose and its and the truth of the papacy as founded by Jesus and as kind of extended into the world by Peter and his successors. So today we asked Joe about bishops in general. Were there bishops in the early church? Is there any evidence that this structure of church that almost all Christians have now, and I know people are shocked when you say that, but most of the Christians in the world by far live and worship in communities that have bishops, priests, and deacons. And that, now for Americans, that might seem odd to say it because we are a predominantly Protestant country. But for most of the church, and even today for most of Christians, this is the structure of the church. Well, we have to defend that. And Joe says, yeah, there were bishops in the early church. Did you want to make any more points before I went to the calls, Joe, or shall we take some calls?
I'll work them in as we respond to callers.
Oh, feeling nimble today. All right. Nate in Dallas, Texas, our old friend Nate. Always glad to have you here, Nate. Thank you for starting us off. Go ahead with your points for Joe.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I just heard that Joe was talking about the papal succession, and it reminded me that a little while back I was looking into this, and the Catholic Encyclopedia, newadvent.org, which has, if I remember correctly, a nil obstat or an imprimatur. I'm going to read it. It says, in the numbering of the successors of St. Peter, certain differences appear in various lists. the two forms of Anacletus and Cletus, a very early occasion, the third pope, but it's reckoned twice. There are a few cases in which it's still doubted with whether particular individuals should be accounted genuine popes or intruders. And according to the view taken of compiler list, is that the Liber Pontificalis, the Annuario Pontificio, the annual yearbook of the popes, if Wikipedia is to be believed, says, quote, the almost 200 corrections, biographies of the pope, in some places it's impossible to determine the ordering of the popes. So doesn't this cast doubt on papal succession? If even the yearbook of the popes, even if the Catholic Encyclopedia admits that we don't know the earliest ones, we don't know the ones in the middle centuries, and what order they came in?
That is a great question. Those are really two separate issues. One is specifically about the earliest. There's a couple questions with the very earliest list. And the other one with the Liber Pontificalis is getting to some much more technical issues that aren't just about historical record keeping. So I'm going to answer both questions, but I want to make sure we know that they are really two separate issues. So the first thing is, as the Catholic Encyclopedia notes, there are a lot of lists of the bishops of Rome in the 100s and early 200s. I mentioned Hegesippus, Irenaeus. Hippolytus is another one who has these. Tertullian refers to each of the churches keeping their own records. Like, these are clearly a big thing. But some of the authors who then tell you who the popes are going probably not off of their actual direct consultation of the records immediately, right? But they're going off of their memory. In the same way that if I said, okay, cool, name the last 12 U.S. presidents going back to John F. Kennedy. There's a good chance you would get a few out of order. There's a good chance you might like skip one or get one wrong. So we see a little bit of that we see that sometimes when they're recounting, they'll switch an order around. Now, there are two very particular issues that are going on. One is that there's an Anacletus and a Cletus mentioned, and some of the early Christians think that's two people and some of them think it's one person by two different names. And then the other thing that makes this confusing is that Pope St. Clement, who is the fourth pope the third after Peter, is ordained by Peter and he's mentioned in the New Testament. But he's not ordained a bishop by Peter. He appears to be ordained an elder and then later becomes a bishop. That point got confused in some of the early authors. That they would say, well, this one source is telling me Linus is a successor of Peter, but this other source is telling me that Peter ordained Clement personally. And the thing is, both of those things are true. He just didn't ordain him a bishop. Does that make sense? That like there we can understand, actually, we know why the small errors that crept in, based on just pretty basic things, like one person having two forms of his name, or this whole thing with Clement. And we actually have early Christians talking about this thing. Like, they realized, some of the other authors made this mistake about Clement being the fourth pope versus the second pope. But those are all, like, kind of the forest for the trees, or the trees for the forest, rather, that we shouldn't ignore the fact that, like, all of these authors, whoever they are in total agreement that there is an actual succession from the time of Peter, and second, that the Church of Rome is keeping its own list. Now, that leads to the other question you said about the Liber Pontificalis, which is that later on in the history of the Church, all sorts of issues come up, about whether so-and-so was a valid pope, or you'll have rival claimants to the papacy, that kind of thing. Like, that's a different question of, well, should this person be considered the pope or not? That's a separate question from, does the papacy date back to the time of the apostles? Like, 500 years from now, we could have a dispute over who the true pope is. But that doesn't mean that the papacy wasn't invented by the apostles. So the later stuff, that's a lot of it's really interesting kind of papal drama. In some of these cases, at one point you have three different people claiming to be pope. That's all interesting. Like, how do you make sense of all that when it happens? None of that gets to the question of, did the apostles set up the papacy? Did they set up the episcopacy? Or not. It really is just the early Christians telling us they did, and here's who the first popes were. That's a pretty strong indication for all the minor errors they may have in their storytelling. The last thing I'd say is if you want a good analogy to this, look to the accounts of the resurrection. That some of the resurrection accounts appear to conflict on minor details, and maybe they don't. Like, maybe there's a way that we can make sense of them all. But even a lot of Christian apologists will say, yeah, some of the eyewitnesses may not perfectly remember exactly what they saw, but they all agree that the resurrection happened. And so this is the kind of thing we would expect to happen in real evidence. Like, in real history, there tends to be these small differences in the details. So it is here that, like, if there was just one, like, government-approved list that everybody was reading from, you probably wouldn't find the differences. But if everyone knows that there are these popes, and then they're telling you who the popes are, but going off of their own memory or their own note-taking, then you're more likely to see the minor errors precisely because it's real history and not, you know, some government propaganda or what have you.
Nate, I'm curious. Are you satisfied with that?
Almost. I appreciate it. I think that we don't know enough about those first, second, third, fourth popes after Peter that we have any writings from them or we know where they came from. I don't think we can exclude the possibility that there was some backfilling. Like they said, oh, we don't have a list of succession. Let's use some names that are in the letters in the New Testament. So there's a Cletus, there's a Linus. We'll just use those names and we'll leave it to the imagination for you to say, that's definitely the person in the Bible. I don't think that we can actually draw that without any doubt that that is the person in the Bible. And second, if there is any, any time there was three popes and we accidentally chose the wrong one as the real one, we accidentally chose an anti-pope, then the succession is broken. Even if it was just political intrigue, it still means papal succession was broken. Isn't that
well,
right?
Well, so a couple... that was maybe too brusque of an answer. Let me give you a better answer than that. I'm sorry. I want to answer both. Again, these are like two separate kind of questions, one about the very early church, one about like these controversies in the Middle Ages. In the very early church, the fact that you have Linus as the successor of Peter, who isn't some like known personage in the New Testament, seems like a pretty good case against backfilling, because you're absolutely right. If they were going to make up a list, they would make up the most prominent Roman Christian. And you know who the most prominent Roman Christian was?
Paul.
St. Mark the Evangelist.
Paul.
Or Paul, right. Like, you know, like there are Mark is the interpreter of St. Peter. And yet the unanimous tradition is that Mark founds the church in Alexandria, Egypt, not that he becomes an ex-bishop of Rome, which is what you or I might imagine, or what, you know, if we were reaching for a detail, that's who I'd reach for. I wouldn't reach for someone named Linus who nobody's ever heard of. And then Cletus and Anacletus, where we don't even know if it's one guy or two. But then the other thing you said, Nate, is like, well, we don't have any writings from these guys. We do, actually, from St. Clement. So Clement is, it goes Linus, Cletus, Clement. And Clement writes to the Corinthians about 96 AD. And they preserve the letter, and they tell us it's from Clement. The letter doesn't mention the author. It just says written from the Roman church. But they preserve it. They tell us it's from Clement. There's a unanimous tradition in the second century that Clement's the one who wrote this letter to the Corinthians. So we do actually have a letter from him. And so we know a little bit about him just from, you know, this writing that we have. But then the final thing I'd say is the fact that we don't have a ton of data about them, or the fact that we don't have a lot of information about them now in 2021, doesn't mean that that was true in like 121. Or in 151. Like, you have living memory. You have people who would have been alive during this. You know, Clement is writing in 96, right? So you've got people who are alive then as young adults who would be old men in the latter part of the second century. They would know whether this stuff was true or not, right? Like, the problem with backfilling doesn't really work very well when you get into the historical reality. Like, this is a living group of people, and this is a church. Like, one of the reasons I think it's so cool to look at the church is because it's a lot easier to change your mind about something or to accidentally fall into heresy than it is to change the entire structure of an entire church. So when the entire church is saying, we've always had this structure, they have an argument on their side that it's just like, it's hard to change something that big. So all of that points to this really going back to the apostles. Now, then the last thing you said, Nate, was, what if we backed the wrong horse? There are a few things. One, it depends who the we is there. There were saints who kind of fell for the wrong pope in the Middle Ages. That doesn't discredit apostolic succession. But two, the fact that like maybe there was a time when it was less clear who the pope was, but then all the people claiming to be pope died and then a new pope was appointed. That doesn't seem to break apostolic succession either. There still would be a valid pope in that context. The question, is there a valid pope, is a different philosophical question of like, does everyone know who the pope is? I hope that makes sense.
Nate, thanks. It's always a pleasure when you call. We are about to come up against our next break, so we will have to leave it there. We're talking about bishops in the early church. I think often there is the idea around that there's these few hundred fuzzy years where we don't really know names and dates and we don't know what happened. And so the church can impose its current structure back into the past. I think that that's not true. If you have questions about that, how do we know that there were bishops in the early church? And how can we be confident that the succession was maintained? Give us a call.
Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Does the church have too many rules? Join me, Dr. David Anders, as we answer your questions right here on Called to Communion, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I think you probably could listen to Catholic Radio all day today. And not until you got to us did you hear the name Hegesippus mentioned. I'm not saying that makes us better than other Catholic radio shows. I'm just saying you had to wait until now to hear the name Hegesippus. We're talking about evidence for early bishops in the church. Did the earliest church have bishops? Well, the earliest church had Jesus and the apostles, the disciples, his little community, his little ecclesia. And then it didn't have Jesus because up he went. It didn't have him physically present anymore, but had the apostles. And then what happened? Were there bishops? Was there just a period of just doing our best and getting along and, until the New Testament got assembled at some point? Did we just have the Gospels? What was it? Well, we Catholics, of course, and most Christians maintain that there was a smooth succession from the apostles to the bishops, that Peter was the bishop and in, say, Antioch, and then when he was not the bishop in Antioch, he left someone else there to follow in his footsteps as the bishop, and then he was the bishop in Rome, and when he died, another took his place. That would be Linus. And that succession has continued down to this day. If you have questions about the early church and the bishops, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer. Joe Heschmeyer, the author of the book, Pope Peter, and many other books, but that's probably the most relevant one for this, and an apologist here at Catholic Answers. Joe, I appreciate you having this conversation with us. I wonder if my impression is correct, that I think that in the New Testament, we see bishops appointed by Paul himself, the Apostle Paul, and then letters written to those bishops instructing them in how to be bishops, particularly Timothy, but also Titus. Do I have the correct understanding, or is there some other way to look at the careers of Timothy and Titus?
Yeah, so I really like looking at these two. You know, I think you're very clearly seeing them acting in the roles of bishops. And I use that wording kind of for a reason. So if someone were to say to you, like, I don't see the word Trinity in the Bible, you would respond, yeah, you don't see the word, but you see the concept. Like, you see the reality of the Trinity throughout the New Testament. You see something a little bit similar here. When the Greek words for bishops, which just means overseers or guardians, and deacons, which means servants, are used, they're often used in this really fluid way. Like, Christ is called a servant. He's literally called a deacon. Paul calls himself a deacon. He calls Timothy a deacon. And so many times our Protestant brothers and sisters will say, well, look, it looks like bishop and elder is being used interchangeably here. And the answer to that is, like, yeah, that may be true. That, like, the terms may be used kind of interchangeably, in the same way that you might have the same person being described as a bishop in one place and being described as a deacon in another place, even though we know bishops and deacons weren't the same thing, because the Greek verbs were just, you know, they were commonly used.
Right.
So that's the first thing to know. The question comes up especially in the context of Ephesus, because in Ephesians, St. Paul describes this apparent confusion. And in 1 Timothy as well, this apparent confusion about bishops. I mentioned all of that by way of preamble. So if people are saying, what in the world does this have to do with Timothy and Titus? It's because we see them operating as bishops, even though they're not explicitly called that. With St. Titus, Paul says, well, this is why I left you in Crete, that you might amend what was defective and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. That's Titus 1:5. Now, that's very clearly the role of a bishop. He's got the job of appointing or ordaining the elders in the church. In addition, he's told to teach what befits sound doctrine. He's told in chapter 2, verse 15, declare these things, exhort and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you. So that's really important, because what we see is that clearly the church here in Crete is answerable to one man, Titus.
Yeah.
That's the role of a bishop. Does Paul call him a bishop? He does not. Does he describe him as a bishop? He does. Does he call him to do a thing that only the bishop could do in terms of ordaining elders? He does. So all of that's to say the reality of Titus being a bishop is there. The words, Titus, I left you as a bishop, aren't. You know, this is kind of a cheesy example, but you know what? Like, this is, we often do a little lowbrow. So it's sometimes, like, people who don't have siblings, when they try to write siblings, like for TV shows or movies or books, if you're into those, they'll be like, hey, brother, his sister, you know, and yeah. No brother and sister that I've met have ever talked to each other that way.
Yes, right.
You know? And so, like, it's not surprising that Paul isn't like, hey, bishop, you know, like, no, that's just not how it works. He's describing something that, like, we can tell, like, he doesn't have to tell Titus he's the bishop. He tells him why he's a bishop. The reason he left him was to ordain elders, to teach sound doctrine, and then do all these things. And then he has this proviso that, like, no one disregard you. Like, don't let people just, like, ignore or get around your authority. That's really big, because it shows he's not just, like, one elder they can choose to go to, or they can choose to go to somebody else. Like, no, he's the ruling bishop. That's Titus. Likewise, with Timothy, he says, he recounts how, you know, I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus, that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine. That's 1 Timothy 1:3. He's showing Timothy is in this role of being kind of a doctrinal overseer of, like, you know, making sure people aren't teaching anything false. In chapter 5 of 1 Timothy, he gives all these rules for the instructions for the overseeing of the elders. He says, let the elders who rule well be worthy of a double honor. He says, never admit any charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all. In other words, he's giving him rules for how to oversee the elders. This is, again, the role of a bishop. Now, this is really big because this is at Ephesus, right? So when you're reading Ephesians and when you're reading 1 Timothy, you're seeing two halves of the same story. That the letter to the Ephesians is written to the church at Ephesus. The letter to 1 Timothy is written to the bishop of Ephesus. And this is really big. Like, if you realize, like, Timothy is the bishop of Ephesus, this actually removes what I think is one of the best Protestant arguments from the debate. And what I mean is this, like, Protestants who believe that there were only two tiers in the early church and not three will look at the book of Acts. And it says in Acts chapter 20 that Paul gets together the elders of the church of Ephesus, and he tells them, take heed to yourselves and all the flock in whom the Holy Spirit has made you guardians. That's Acts 20, verse 17 to 18. But the word guardians there could literally be translated as bishops. And so some Protestants will say, well, he's just called the elders bishops. That's the thing I described before. That he, just like he might call the bishop a servant, which literally is diakonos, deacon. That because these words have a literal as well as a technical meaning, it's not always clear which one's being used. So Protestants will sometimes point to Acts 20 and say, it looks like the elders are the bishops of Ephesus. And so it's good to know, well, yes, but if you look at 1 Timothy, you realize that's wrong. There's one bishop of Ephesus. We even know who it is. It's St. Timothy. The last thing to say about the Ephesian church, as I was doing some research for the book that I've been working on called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, which has a whole chapter dedicated to this question. One of the things that I'd never really taken this argument seriously, but the more I looked into it, the more I realized it's a really good argument, is that Revelation, the first seven churches that are described in the first three chapters, there are these seven angels of the seven churches. And look, the book of Revelation, really weird. And I mean, I say that I love the book, but I get that people are just like, I don't know what I'm reading. I don't know what's going on. Understandable. But the seven angels have historically been understood not as literal angels, but as the bishops of the seven churches, one of them being Ephesus. And why are they understood that way? Because the angels are warned about things like their imminent arrest, and like told, like, you've fallen away and you need to come back, things that wouldn't make any sense to literally tell an angel. And so for a lot of reasons, like, there's five different major scholarly theories about who the angels of the church are. And the best one is that this is a bishop because he's being held spiritually accountable for the good of this church. And so in that sense, he is the angel, the messenger of God. The last thing I'll say on that is the book of Malachi uses that image of the priest as the angel of the people, or the angel of the Lord to the people, I should say. And so it's not crazy to read angels as a reference to, like, God's priests, and in this case, God's bishops. So all of that to kind of bring all that together is to say, yeah, Titus, he's the bishop of Crete. Timothy, he's the bishop of Ephesus. This idea the church has a threefold structure goes back to the apostles, and we see it everywhere we get a close look at the structure of Christian churches in the early church.
Again, our number 888-318-7884. We're talking about bishops in the early church. Nate, I wanted to argue a bit, but if you are a person who would like to say, wait a second, that's not what they say at the church that I go to, at my mega church or my minor church, or what's the opposite of a mega church? Like a little church.
I like micro church. Yeah, house church, actually.
House church, probably, yeah. Then we'd love to take your call. We really would. We'd love to talk about it. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. And whether you call or not, you can have a free ebook. Just go to shop.catholic.com, Answering Protestant Objections to Catholic Teachings, free right now in ebook format at shop.catholic.com.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
I'm Kimberly Hahn, and my new show, Beloved and Blessed, is now on EWTN Radio. Every week, I share scripture and my personal experience to speak to the desires and strengths of all women so that each of us can better live out our vocations as daughters of God. Tune in to find inspiration, hope, and strength in each episode.
Don't miss Beloved and Blessed with Kimberly Hahn, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, only on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our number is 888-318-7884, and I'll just lay it out for you. The way it works is Jesus founded a church. He made Peter the head of that church, and he gave it 12 apostles in total. Even replenished the numbers of the apostles after the loss of Judas so that there would be 12 witnesses, eyewitnesses to every year, every month, every week, every day of his earthly ministry, even called other apostles like the Apostle Paul and Barnabas, and upon these apostles, he founded his church. And the way the apostles went about securing that foundation was they appointed men as bishops and priests and deacons, so that when they passed from the scene, there would still be a structure and an order to the church. And that structure and order has persisted to this day. We see it in the Orthodox churches. We see it in the Eastern Catholic churches. We see it in the Latin Rite Catholic Church. And even in many other places, you see that basic structure as you do in Anglicanism. There was, in the 16th century, a time when people started to say, nope, that's not the case. We just want the Bible alone. We're not taking all of that structure. And now we have a conflict in the world between a Protestant view and the older Christian view of the structure of the Catholic Church. Whichever side you're on, your call is welcome. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, and he wrote one of the finest books you will read on papal succession. And so he is well-versed in the history of the bishops and the structures of the church that include the bishops. You're welcome to call and ask Joe whatever question you'd like. 888-318-7884. We'll go now to Alan in Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on Oklahoma Catholic Radio. Alan, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thank you very much. I wanted to ask about the last couple of years, it seems like there's been a lot of people who's been very vocal about they disagree with this thing or that thing that their bishop has said. And I'm just curious the respect that we should give to our bishops. And, if we happen to disagree with something, I mean, should that really be a public thing or, how should that kind of thing be handled?
That's a great question. And it gives me an excuse to mention St. Ignatius of Antioch, who I promise I'd mention later on in the hour. So let me address a couple things. First, the book of Hebrews has what I think is the best kind of one-line advice in Hebrews 13, not advice, order. Hebrews 13:17 just tells us to obey our leaders because they're the ones who are going to stand account. In other words, like, to be the spiritual head of someone is to be responsible for the care of their soul. That's a really weighty responsibility. And no one should want that lightly. Like, no one should want to take that on lightly. In the same way, being a parent, there's this a real spiritual accountability that goes with that. And so it's not something you just, like, trivially do because, you want, like, hey, I want to have, like, a ton of kids to make cool Instagram photos. Like, that's not a good enough reason. Like, you're taking on a real weight. They're a real burden. Likewise, the bishop, he is going to be accountable for what he's done. And so we're told, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they're keeping watch over your souls as men who will have to give account. Let them do this joyfully and not sadly, for that would be of no advantage to you. In other words, your bishop has taken on a really large spiritual burden. And you don't have to make his life constantly worse. In fact, you really shouldn't. Like, you should actually make his life better. As much as you can kind of grease the wheels and make everything run more smoothly in your diocese, even if the bishop is someone who you disagree with on everything, even if the bishop is someone who you just hate his guts, you should obey him, you should submit to him, and you should do it joyfully and not make his life, you know, a living purgatory. That's the first thing. The second is that there is a twofold respect due to the bishop. St. Thomas Aquinas describes this, that you have the respect of office and the respect of person. But the respect of office is, I respect the bishop because he's the bishop. And that's, it really is just a form of respecting the authority that, that God has set in place. Hopefully, that's accompanied also by, this is a very good man, this is a very good bishop, and so I can respect him as well. That won't always be the case, frankly. And the New Testament is not oblivious to this, because the authorities were not always great at the time of Christ. You may remember they did like this whole thing where they betrayed Jesus to the Romans to be crucified, and then they helped persecute and tried to kill the early Christians. It was not like it, not the high point of, you know, piety. And yet, when the Christians come before the Sanhedrin, you see St. Paul, for instance, who insults the high priest because he doesn't know who it is, then apologizing because he said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. That's Acts 23, verse 5. So we should respect the office, even if we don't respect the person. But ideally, we have respect for both the office and the person. Now, the third part of that, there may be something where it's not just like I disagree with decisions he's making, or I don't like that he put this priest here, or I don't like that he did this. There may be an actual doctrinal or some other spiritual problem where it may be appropriate to speak out. And then I would just say, in general, follow Matthew chapter 18, that you handle a situation as privately as possible, and then you kind of make it more public as the situation requires, but you don't needlessly just like share scandal, even if the other person is wrong. You don't needlessly just say, haha, my bishop made a mistake. It's really bad. He looks stupid. Let me blast it on the internet. That is not what we're called to as Christians. You might have to privately like send him an email and then maybe speak out publicly if the situation demands it. But those situations are rare. The example of that happening in scripture is in Galatians 2, when St. Paul stands up to St. Peter, because Peter is publicly sinning in terms of the way he's handling the Gentile versus the Jewish Christians. Paul realizes there's a bigger spiritual problem if he sits back and says nothing than if he confronts the situation, and then he talks about it afterwards. And people love to point to that example, and it's true. That's a good example. But you're not going to find a lot of those examples. So if you've got more examples in your own life than we see in the entire early church, that may be a sign that you're not being judicious enough in like choosing your battles. The very last thing I want to say, just because I promised to get Ignatius of Antioch in there, is that, you know, he talks about the importance of this. For instance, he tells the Ephesians, he praises them for the fact that their justly renowned presbytery, or like the elders worthy of God, is fitted as exactly to the bishops as the strings are to the harp, so that in your concord and harmonious love, Jesus Christ is sung. And he says that it's just a very beautiful image, you know, this idea like we should be harmonious as much as we can because it proclaims Jesus to the world. Like when people see Catholics tearing each other apart, that does not make them want to become Catholic. So as much as we can, we should strive for that unity, not just in like a kumbaya superficial sense, but in this real sense that like kumbaya means, you know, come by here, Lord. Like we want to proclaim Christ. And so in that sense, we do want Jesus Christ to be sung. And so for all of those reasons, I would say from the very beginning, Ignatius of Antioch in particular is almost obsessed with this idea about that in obeying the bishop, in doing everything in harmony with the bishop, like this is one very concrete way we can live out discipleship in a beautiful way. And that's still true today.
Alan, thank you very, very much for the call. We're talking about the early bishops of the Catholic Church. Joe, it's a time of great liturgical conflict in the church nowadays. I just don't know if you want to be on the record putting Catholic Answers on the side of singing Kumbaya. I just am not sure that you want to make that move. I get where you're going, but
is that not a Latin phrase?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure. Anyway, 888-318-7884, the number, 888-318-7884. So, Joe, I've said several times that around the world today, even, and certainly for the first 1,500 years of the church, a unified Christian understanding of the role of a bishop. The bishop is the successor to the apostles. And so much so that even for us in the Catholic Church, I don't know, actually, you can tell me how it is for folks in the Eastern churches, in the Orthodox churches, how they feel about Catholic bishops, but we accept their bishops as legitimate, real bishops. And so their sacraments are valid sacraments. That's how important the office of bishop is in the history of Christianity.
Yeah, actually, there is a little bit of a difference between East and West on this, and specifically within Orthodoxy, not within Eastern Catholicism. Within Eastern Orthodoxy, you will have some who argue that if someone isn't Orthodox, meaning Catholics and any other non-Eastern Orthodox, that they therefore cannot have valid holy orders. And so they will attempt to ordain, like if a Catholic priest becomes Eastern Orthodox, they will go through an ordination rite as if he's not already a priest. That is somewhat of a novelty historically. That is kind of an anti-Catholic strand of Orthodoxy that actually doesn't date back that long in the history of the Orthodox Church. But you'll find it. You'll find both of those views. But the better view, and the one you'll find within Orthodoxy, and is certainly the view of the Catholic Church, is that that's even someone who may be defective on some points, even someone who may be in schism, could still be a valid bishop or a valid priest. That's not an impediment to the possibility of ordination.
Oh, as we've seen in the society.
Indeed, indeed.
Society of St. Pius X.
Yeah, although they're not full schismatics. There are full schismatics that this would still be true of. Because you will find, like, Sede Vacantis, who are fully schismatic and still have valid holy orders. And all of this matters for a real, like, particular reason, because like the Western, one of the reasons the West has a much better articulated view of this and a more nuanced view is we had to grapple with this more, because in the West, in the early church, there was the crisis of Donatism. So basically, some of the bishops and some of the priests either didn't do enough to stand up to the Roman government during like the anti-Christian persecutions, or they maybe defected from the faith themselves and you know, sometimes even cooperated in this horrible persecution of Christians. And so then when the persecution's over, they kind of come hat in hand and want to come back and be Christian leaders. And understandably, the early Christians aren't thrilled at that. And so it forces this really important conversation about, okay, well, if you become a priest of Jesus Christ, can you lose that? Are your sacraments still valid? All of that. And what comes out of that conversation is a much better sense that no, like you share in the priesthood of Jesus Christ eternally, because it's Christ is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek, this order, this holy orders, this idea of sharing an eternal priesthood without beginning or end. That's what you participate in. And so a bishop or priest is validly ordained, even if they're not in total communion with Rome, even if they have some wacky ideas here or there, they still remain a bishop or priest because of what's happened with, at the level of their soul, because of the nature of the sacrament.
It's an extraordinary office, the office of bishop. I mean, that when you talk about Paul appointing Timothy and Titus and the description he gives of their duties, they're not so, I mean, the office, I'm sure it didn't have probably a chancery or a, you know, an archives or whatever, or maybe it did, I don't know. You know, it just seems like much of the, what goes around the bishop's office is all later accretions, but the fundamentals of teaching sound doctrine and appointing priests to care for the people, this is essentially what a bishop does today.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. You know, I like to use the analogy of like these tech startups, you know, your Bill Gates or your Steve Jobs types who start these like major companies, but it really is an outgrowth of what they began in their garage, right? It's the same thing, just bigger.
Yeah, yeah. Joe, you'll stay for a second hour and do open forum with us?
Let's do it.
All right, we already got people on the line for open forum. So hang on if you're on the line, if you haven't called yet. Open forum means open to anybody. Ask any question you want. If you're like, darn it, I wanted to talk about that bishop thing and I was driving and now, no, go ahead, call. We don't care. We'd love to talk with you about anything. Open forum. right after this with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live. The number to call, 888-318-7884. Right back. Finish on a high note.